TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. The execution of Martin Luther King. More secrecy surrounds the murder of Martin Luther King than even that of the Kennedys. Most people still believe that James Earl Ray, who never even had a trial, was the lone assassin. Dr. William Pepper, who became Ray's lawyer, has uncovered evidence of the involvement of the Memphis Police Department, the U.S. government, and even the U.S. Army in a plot to kill one of the most influential leaders of the 20th century. His book, An Act of State, The Execution of Martin Luther King, represents a quarter century of detective and legal work. In a moving turn of circumstance and historic coincidence, Bill Pepper, who today is an author and acclaimed lawyer, is the same Bill Pepper who as a young man went to Vietnam as a reporter. He returned with photos of children burned by napalm that shocked the world. Martin Luther King saw these photos in Rampart's magazine in early 1967. Witnesses say that he wept as he looked at them. He asked to meet the young man who had taken them, and thus began a friendship between Martin Luther King and Bill Pepper and the King family. Bill Pepper spoke at a San Francisco bookstore in February of 2003. He takes us back to Riverside Church in New York, where he witnessed Martin Luther King's compassion with the victims in Vietnam in his first major anti-war speech. Here is the voice of Bill Pepper.
That passion came out in his speech on April 4, 67 at Riverside Church, where he said that his native land had become the greatest purveyor of violence on the face of the earth. Quoting Thoreau, he said, "We have come to a point where we use massively improved means to accomplish unimproved ends. And what we should be doing is focusing on not just the neighborhood that we have created, but making that worldwide neighborhood into a brotherhood." And we were going entirely in the opposite direction. And this was what he was pledging to fight against. We spoke very early in the morning following that Riverside address, and he said, "Now you know they're all going to turn against me. We're going to lose money. SCLC will lose all of its corporate contributions. All the major civil rights leaders are going to turn their back on me, and all the major media will start to tarnish and to taint and to attack me, and I will be called everything even up to and including a traitor." So he said, "We must persevere and build a new coalition that can be effective in this course of peace and justice." Well, that coalition came to be known as the National Conference for New Politics. It was an umbrella organization, and it held its first and last convention in Chicago over the Labor Day weekend of 1967. And it had 5,000 delegates, maybe the largest convention of people ever assembled in the history of this country at the Palmer House in Chicago. And they came from every walk of life, every socioeconomic class, every ethnic group. And the purpose was to form this coalition, umbrella coalition, that would effectively coordinate a massive third-party political campaign against the Johnson administration and Johnson's reelection, but at the same time develop grassroots organizing capabilities in the communities across America. Well, it wasn't to be, although it continued and struggled for a period of a year, but it wasn't to be because of government's wiliness and our naivete. We never appreciated the extent to which government would go to undermine and undercut that kind of movement. And they were responsible for the formation of the first Black Caucus. And that Black Caucus was largely led by agents provocateurs who came from the Blackstone Rangers, organizations of that sort in Chicago. And they corralled each Black delegate who came in, and brought them into a room and formed this unity of all black delegates. We thought this was healthy and there would be then this bloc that would be in the vote and introduce the concerns of the black community across America. We didn't know that it was government-induced and government-sponsored and government-paid for, and that the leaders were gangsters. Blackstone Rangers would surface again and again in the course of the movement. So Martin delivered the keynote address at the convention, and as he was speaking, a note was passed over my shoulder to me, and I read it, and it said, get him out of here after he finishes his speech, or we will take him hostage and humiliate him before the world. They were so afraid that if this man stayed on for the substantive part of the convention, that he, as a unifier, might bridge the differences and might overcome the provocation that was designed to disrupt the convention. So we did get Martin out of the Palmer House very quickly after his speech and went on with the convention. And it was all downhill from there. They forced through resolutions that simply were so antagonistic to sections of the movement and engendered such hostility that all the money dried up for that noble cause. And they were successful. That being the case, we struggled and worked in that last year of his life. And I remember the last time I saw him alive, I think it was in late February, he had started to become involved already in the sanitation workers' strike. In his own mind, he thought that this was the basis for the encampment of the poor people in Washington, and this was a good launching pad. And he sympathized with all the goals of the sanitation workers in Memphis, and so the rest is history. He was assassinated on the 4th of April, 1968, 1 year to the day. It's interesting, from the time he delivered the Riverside speech. We went to the memorials, Spock and I, and the funeral, and then I walked away from political activity. I'd had my fill of it. And Ben and Julian Bond and others went up to see Bobby Kennedy, who had asked, invited us all to come. And I didn't know him in 68. I knew him, a much younger person, when I handled a campaign of his as a citizen's chairman in Westchester County, New York, when he ran for the Senate. And I didn't like him at all. I thought he was opportunistic, and all those things that you have heard about Bobby Kennedy I thought were true. And I saw them, confronted them directly. But the Bob Kennedy who was killed in 68, I think, was a very different person, and I regard it as one of my sadnesses that I did not see him at the end, because he had made an overture to Martin to run as a vice presidential candidate with him. It was not generally known, but when he announced, he made his announcement in March, I guess it was 15th or 16th, he made contact with Martin. And I'm sure that contact was known. Now, 8-9 years later, Abernathy called me and asked me to go up to the prison with him. Actually, 10, it was late 77. He asked me to go to the prison with him and interrogate James Earl Ray. And I said, this is a funny request, Ralph. Well, 10 years after the fact, why would you want to do that? And do you have some questions about it? Isn't Ray guilty? I didn't know anything about the case. I didn't want to know about it at that point. And he said, I just have some questions. Will you come along with me? And I still don't fully understand why he did that. He said, but I want you to interrogate him, and I want to watch him when you do that. So I said, well, it's going to take me some while to get up to speed on this case because I don't know anything about it. So it did take some time. And in August of 78, finally, we went, and we went through this session of 5 hours intensive interrogation of James Earl Ray. His lawyer at the time was Mark Lane, was there. A body language specialist from Harvard, Howie Behrens, came and he sat in a corner, just watched James's movements as I put him really through a rather rigorous, painful time. He was very different than we expected to find. He was shy, docile, soft-spoken, thoughtful, and not at all the kind of racist figure that had been depicted in the media. Not at all. He knew very little about weapons, very clearly had virtually no skill at all with them. He was a petty thief, a burglar, hold-up man, but he was totally incompetent at that. He was known for showing up too late. Supermarkets, he wanted to stick up, and the time lock would already have been fixed on the safe. And the staff would say, look, there's nothing we can do about this. And he said, they said, we'll give you our money. He said, I don't want your money. I don't want to rob working people. I want the money from this corporation, yeah, type of thing. He had a virtually non-existent the marksmanship score when he took a test in the Army, and he didn't know much about guns. When he was instructed to buy a weapon that became the throwdown gun in the assassination, he bought a 243 Winchester rather than a 30-06 that he was told of, and he didn't know the difference between them. And when he showed the weapon he had bought to Raoul, who was controlling him, he sent him back to exchange it, which is a matter of record. He went back and exchanged this one rifle for another the next day. And that's not something he thought of himself. It just was the wrong gun. The guy wanted a 30-06 caliber rifle, so they had a 30-06 rifle as the throwdown gun. And so that's why he had to go back and exchange it. Well, after the interview, we became convinced, Abernathy and I became convinced that he was not the shooter. Didn't know what other role he might have played, but it was clear he was not the assassin of Martin Luther King. This guy couldn't have done that. But he raised so many questions that I'd never heard raised before, that had never been answered, that I just decided I would begin to go into Memphis and talk to some people, become familiar with the terrain and the crime scene, and see if I could get some answers to those questions. And I did. And the more I began to probe around, the more concerned I got about new questions that were unanswered. And I'd hoped that the Select Committee on Assassinations would solve that problem, because they were in session at the time, and I hoped they would solve it. Well, their report came out in 1979, and they didn't solve it. All they did was to continue the official history of the state's case, which was that James Earl Ray was the lone assassin and that he was guilty. So I kept going back and forth visiting him and asking him questions, and then going in off and on into Memphis, and then occasionally into New Orleans. And slowly things started to come together to the point where 10 years on in this process, I became convinced that not only was Ray not the shooter, but that he was an unknowing patsy. And it was at that point in 1988 that I agreed to represent him. So I became his lawyer, and I was his lawyer for the last 10 years of his life, trying very hard to get him a trial. He never had a trial. It's amazing that, of course, most people in the United States, if not the world, never understand that James Earl Ray never had a trial, that he was coerced into copying a guilty plea by Percy Foreman, who's his second lawyer. And people say, well, why would he plead guilty? Goodness me. Well, when you put that question to James, his answer was always the same. Look, he told me all kinds of things. I always wanted this trial. Right down to the end, I was trying to get this trial. But Percy said to me, you know, your dad's a parole violator. He's going to be sent back to jail 50 years after violating that parole. They'll make sure he's locked up. Your whole family will be harassed forever. They convicted you anyway because the media's got you wiped out as the killer. You haven't got a chance. They're going to fry you, Jimmy. But the thing that really convinced him to get rid of Foreman by pleading was Percy's statement that, I'm not in good health, James. I cannot give you the best defense because I'm not in good health. And he said to me, that was it. When my lawyer said to me, I'm not in good health and I can't give you the best defense, that really started to worry me. So he said, what you should do, Foreman said, what you should do is plead guilty. Then make a motion for a new trial, get a new lawyer, and you overturn the guilty plea, and then you're off and away. James said, but I don't have any money for a new lawyer. So Foreman said, well, don't worry about that, James. I'll give you Brother Jerry $500. He can go hire you a new lawyer. But you got to make an agreement that you will not cause any problems at the guilty plea hearing. You'll just take that guilty plea. Well, Percy not only said that, he put it in writing. And we got a copy of Percy's letter to James, where he said, "Dear James, I'm going to give this $500 to your brother, the condition that you plead guilty and you do not cause any undue disturbances at this guilty plea hearing." He actually put that in writing. Remarkable admission. So James certainly, he pled. He did cause a little problem at the guilty plea hearing, but nevertheless, he pled. And Jerry got the $500. And James didn't wait for the lawyer to be retained, but he filed himself, pro se, by himself, a petition for a new trial. He pled on March 10th. That was when he was guilty and convicted and sentenced to 99 years. And on March 13th, 3 days later, he filed. And from March 13th until the day that he died, James Earl Ray was trying to get a trial. Well, on March 31st, the judge who had sentenced him and who had overseen the guilty plea hearings was reviewing the petition for a new trial, had told some people that he was concerned about certain aspects of the case. Whether that's serious or not, one doesn't know. And he was found dead in his office with his head on James's motion papers of a heart attack. You can speculate what that means. It may mean nothing. It just may mean that the man was under a lot of stress for a lot of different reasons, had a heart attack, and he happened to be reviewing those papers. And when he collapsed, the head went on those with James's papers. But there were two. There's a law in Tennessee that says if you if a judge dies and you make a motion for a new trial, in the course of that motion for ruling on it, the judge dies, you get a new trial automatically. There were two people who had filed those motions before Preston Battle. One was James Earl Ray, and the other person was the one who got the trial. James didn't, of course. So he went on all of those years trying to get that trial and was unsuccessful. Meanwhile, the state's case was articulated in a number of books by Gerald Frank, chap called Macmillan, eventually commentaries by David Garrow, and ultimately a fellow called Gerald Posner. They're always the same line, always the same story, unyieldingly lone assassin, no conspiracy, and no deviation at all. And that's been the case from the beginning to the end. Well, I tried to get James a trial for many years. But in the initial stages, we lost all the way up through the Supreme Court. We were denied. And I guess we finished that process around 1990, 89, 90, 91. It was certainly completed. In 1992, I got the idea that why don't we just try to do this trial on television? And so HBO in this country and Thames Television in the UK sponsored a television trial called The Trial of James Earl Ray. We tried the case in 1992, which was, of course, the 25th anniversary of the assassination of Martin King. The judge was a former federal judge, Marvin Frankel, out of New York. Very tough judge. We fought all the time, particularly in chambers. Eventually, we became friends, but it was very hostile during the trial. The prosecutor was Hickman Ewing Jr., a former U.S. attorney who had won 200 cases, 200 straight prosecution cases as a U.S. attorney. And some of you may know him and know the name. He was Ken Starr's number two on the Whitewater investigations for a number of months, if not years. The jury came from all over the country, and the rules were very strictly adhered to were the rules, criminal procedure of the state of Tennessee. So it was a serious trial. It had no script or anything. The witnesses were not scripted in any way. It took the jury about 7 hours after that television trial to come back with a verdict of not guilty, James Earl Ray. You probably never heard of that because it was not reported anywhere. And if it was, it was mentioned once or twice in a couple of media entities. It was called entertainment, It wasn't really serious, you see. It was some form of entertainment. But what it did do was to bring to the fore witnesses and information that had not been possible to get before that. So that way was very helpful. And in one instance, we had four witnesses whose testimony would have caused the indictment of a man called Lloyd Jowers, who owned Jim's Grill, which was a cafe at the bottom on the ground floor of the rooming house from which the shot supposedly was fired from the bathroom window. And behind Jim's Grill, there was a big sort of vacant lot, bushy area, heavily overgrown at the time, and it backed onto the Lorraine Motel where Martin King stayed. So these people gave me enough evidence as a result of the trial and discovering them and the investigation. I had over 22 investigators working for me in the course of that preparation to indict Jowers. Jowers knew about it. I'd known Lloyd Jowers since 1978. He's one of the first people I talked to. So I'd known this guy for 14 years already, and he, of course, never admitted anything, and he lied about everything. But as these witnesses now started to assemble, and it was powerful testimony against him, one of them was his former, and she was still active as his girlfriend and lover at the time, so she became former by 1992. But back in 68, she and Lloyd had a thing going, and she, her story was that she came into the Grill on the afternoon of April 4th, and she didn't see Lloyd around anywhere, and he was the manager, and he's the short order cook, and he helped him do everything. And she saw the kitchen door closed, which was unusual, so she opened the kitchen door, thinking that, well, maybe he's out in the back fooling around with some of those local ladies, because she never trusted him, really. And as she got into the kitchen, she saw the kitchen door was open, leading to the outside. And as she approached that kitchen, open kitchen door, she heard a gunshot. And she was startled, but she still went on. And as she got to the door, into the doorway, here comes Lloyd running through the bushes, carrying a still-smoking rifle. And he brushes past her quickly, comes inside, bends down to take the shell out and break it down, and says to her plaintively, you know, Betty, you wouldn't do anything to hurt me, would you? And she said, no, Lloyd, of course not. Of course I wouldn't. So he throws the shell down the commode, the toilet back of the kitchen, and stuffed it up. And so in doing it, then covered the rifle with a cloth and brought it out and put it under the shelf. Well, Betty'd known about this, of course, since 1968. And it was only in 1992, I think December 1992, where she finally agreed to tell me this story. And I'd known her for a lot of years. And Lloyd tried to keep me from even finding out where she lived. And then there were three others with similar incriminating pieces of information. A taxi driver who saw the murder weapon, whom Lloyd asked to get rid of the murder weapon or hold on to it. There was a whole series of different witnesses. So Lloyd was in trouble, and he knew it. And he said to his lawyer, you go and get me immunity from prosecution and I'll tell everything I know about this killing. So his lawyer, Lewis Garrison, goes off to meet with the district attorney general and tries to get immunity for Lloyd's. He says, Lloyd will tell you everything. You know, this is the case of the century. You can be the most famous prosecutor in America. You can break this case. Not only does Lloyd not get immunity from prosecution, but the district attorney general never interviewed him, never even spoke to him. So nobody wanted to prosecute Lloyd, but he still was worried. So Lloyd conjures up with his lawyer and some others the idea that he'll try to get this story out publicly. So they contact Sam Donaldson, if you know who he is, but he was an ABC journalist who ran a program called Primetime Live. And Donaldson agreed to have this, put Jowers on and let him tell this story. So Jowers goes on television and tells the story on Primetime Live. And it seems like it's a big news story. I actually got it covered in the Observer in England. I had been living all this time, by the way, in England, not in the United States. I had moved to England in 1980, 81, and moved my family there. And I was a visiting scholar at Cambridge at the time, and that was a much nicer place to raise children, considering some of the things I was getting myself into. So The next morning, after the Primetime Live program, there was no coverage at all of this. Not even ABC News treated their own program as a newsworthy event. There's no coverage at all and no mention in the press.
My apologies for interrupting the account of the assassination of Martin Luther King at this crucial moment. Please return for the next broadcast of TUC Radio for a report on the involvement of army sharpshooters at the crime scene in front of the Lorraine Motel. You heard the attorney and author, Dr. William Pepper. He became the counsel for James Earl Ray after he became convinced of his innocence. As close friend of the King family, he helped them for 3 decades to lift the veil of silence and deceit that still covers the death of one of the most important leaders of the 20th century. Bill Pepper is the author of An Act of State, The Execution of Martin Luther King. This was part one of a 2-part synopsis of a period in U.S. history that has been obscured, distorted, and suppressed. This was a rebroadcast of my 2003 program, The Execution of Martin Luther King. I recorded William Pepper at Modern Times Books in the San Francisco Mission District. The back windows were open to the Linda Street playground, and young voices were floating into our silent assembly. 15 years have passed since then, and William Pepper has not given up on this cause. In 2016, his book, The Plot to Kill King, was published by Skyhorse. The book is 700 pages long, and the 400-page appendix represents 26 years of research. The guilty parties remain the same since the publication of An Act of State, but the evidence has mounted with new details of the night of the murder, the trial, and why James Earl Ray was chosen to take the fall. What is left for us to contemplate today is the fact of a government-sanctioned assassination of one of the nation's greatest leaders, and why U.S. military and intelligence organizations had the power to silence King's growing criticism of the war on Vietnam and of his anti-poverty campaign that may be revived in 2018. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations and depends on the support of listeners like you. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.